I think we got off to a great start last night, and I'm looking forward to shoring up the pillars of liberty throughout the day so that the great kingdom of England and Wales and Scotland, part of Ireland, and the United States can continue on its way unhampered by the enemies of liberty. So this morning we're going to have three talks, and I'm delighted that General Cy Bunting can start things off. Are you starting things off?
I am starting things off.
Oh, so, who are you?
Kevin Williams.
I see.
Happy to trade if you would rather start. That's fine.
You go right ahead. I must be looking at an old.
I have Kevin, Keith, and Andy McCarthy this morning, and then Andrew Roberts, you, and me in the afternoon.
Oh, that's fine. That's fine. When I received whatever the initial thing was, yes. It listed 18 speakers, all of them impressed.
Aren't you glad that we changed it?
It said title to be furnished later.
I see. That's what we
all of whom had said, well, I'm coming. I haven't read anything, but I'm coming.
Well, this is the later iteration.
They were being listed in order of imminence, not appearance.
Well, I'm moderately pleased to welcome Kevin Williamson, who's going to talk about liberty as an evolutionary mechanism. Kevin, thanks.
Giving Roger a hard time last night because I have to appear in the worst speaking spot, which is after Dan Hannon, but before anyone's had a drink. That's not the greatest place to be. Speaking of which, I made the mistake of switching from sensible white wine to Jack Daniels at some point last night, and I think I may have joined a wedding party.
A while, but it was. I saw your wife, actually.
Another one? Last thing I really need. So having denounced democracy at dinner last night, I'll get around to denouncing the rest of the political models this morning. But before I really get started, I just wanted to say it is a real pleasure to be here in Sully Place, but also to be at an event organized in part by the New Criterion, which I had the pleasure of writing for, but have much longer than that had the pleasure of being a reader. It was a big part of my education. It was something to come across a journal in which people had strong opinions about art critics. I didn't know people actually had opinions about art critics. And I remember being 20 or so and reading about Clint Greenberg and Clint Brooks and people like that. And people I'd never heard of and seemed to have very, very strong beliefs about. So it took me a while to get caught up on that. There was a wonderful collection published in the 90s called Against the Grain, which I was your first 10 years, something like that, which really was my my introduction to that. So there aren't a lot of intellectual advantages of being a member of my generation, which is unfortunately sort of illiterate and crude, but unlike Roger, at least I had the benefit of growing up with the New Criterion instead of having to be among the people who started it, which is a real labor.
Where were you born, 1980 or...?
72.
Now, I think you might be the youngest person here.
Yeah. Yeah, someone was pointing that out, which is always nice.
Except and, you.
The number of organizations at which I get to be the youngest member is dwindling, unfortunately.
Get used to it.
Roger just came from my 40th birthday, which was a lot of fun, which actually kind of brings me where I was going to start, because I was thinking about that maybe 40, and it's not a terribly long period of time, and it doesn't seem that long to me anyway. 1972, but if you think about it, when I was born, which wasn't just a lifetime ago, Spain, Greece, Portugal were all under various kinds of fascistic dictatorships. You don't have to go back too much before where I was born to find almost all of Europe, except for Britain, under various kinds of dictatorship. Even France under de Gaulle was not exactly the most democratic place in the world, with rule by decree and all of that. Which always puts me in mind of the fact that what we have in the United States and Britain and the English-speaking world is deeply, deeply abnormal. This is not the normal state of human affairs. It's exceptional. It has happened only once in history for a very small group of people. It's fragile. And if we're not careful, of course, it goes away. there's any lesson to be learned from Europe, it's that. So I was thinking, the Berlin Wall came down when I was in high school. I think I was a junior in high school. I remember watching that. And I was just last summer at my 20th year reunion. So it's been 20 years, 21 years, I guess, now since that got around to happening. But we're still debating about central planning. How is this possible? Socialism is maybe the most discredited idea in the history of ideas. Say what you will about astrology or alchemy, at least they led at some point to some real science. Some useful knowledge eventually came out of those fields. You can't say as much for scientific socialism, but we no longer use the word very often. I mean, there's some Europeans, of course, who still refer to their parties as socialist. In the United States, we don't call our socialist party the socialist party. We call it something else. We call it bipartisan, actually, is what we call it. But there is still this tremendous reflex toward the idea of central planning, that you can have some committee of very smart people, very wise people who are, of course, angelic in their motives. As we all know, people in politics are always the smartest and best among us, and that they're going to rationally lay out how the healthcare system is going to work, how monetary policy is going to work, how transportation or energy, or these other sorts of things that you have as government planners thinking that they can get themselves in charge of and run in a rational and predictable and productive manner. And of course, it's just superstition. It's been superstition since the beginning, but it's one of those superstitions that simply will not die. In the past couple of years, I've written a great deal about the problems associated with central planning. I wrote a book about socialism, almost entirely about the central planning problem. Socialism has other problems too, like gulags and prison camps and those sorts of things, but I didn't get into that too much. And I've for the most part held to Hayek's view that the real problem with central planning is an information problem. Knowledge is distributed to society. There is no good, useful, practical way to organize and centralize that knowledge, and to have any sort of real, meaningful, rational central planning would require people to have access to events that are outside what I call the epistemic horizon, the ability to actually know and understand what's going on in society. And societies just turn out to be way too complex for that to happen. But I have had to modify those views a little bit in the last year or so, after having done some reading and some research, which is that I do think it is possible to have a society with a high degree of rational central planning of the economy and other aspects of society on one condition, which is that there's no social change, there's no innovation in society. So if you had an absolutely static society in which there was no new technology, no new firms, no new products, no demographic change, no culture change, no immigration over great long periods of time, you might actually be able to establish something like a meaningful central planning regime. I think these conditions held true in Egypt at some point during its pharaonic history, where they had essentially no social change for a couple hundred years at a time. And so maybe you could do it in that kind of context, but the question, of course, is why would you ever want to live in a society like that? It would be a miserable, backward, fragile, and vulnerable state of affairs to be in. And you would be, of course, constantly getting poor relative to your peer societies and competitors. So those are our real choices. We're either going to have an innovative society, a society in which real change happens in unpredictable and unknowable kind of ways, or you can have these more attempts at central planning. You get one or the other. And I think it's obvious which one those of us in this room would like to have, but we are very much in the minority. Most people distrust the idea of a system or a set of social arrangements in which there is nobody in charge. But all of our best systems are ones that it turns out there's no one really in charge of. But we are sort of mad for innovation, and that's not just in the West. I mean, even our most reactionary friends in Waziristan would like to change certain things about their society, at least to become more powerful, to annihilate their enemies, and to more efficiently enslave and oppress their people. No one really wants that kind of long-term stasis. We often talk about the problem of liberty as a moral good. If I had a dollar, as they say, for everyone who's always said, someone needs to make the moral intellectual case for free markets and free enterprise and individual liberties. Well, I wouldn't be rich, but I'd have a few more dollars than I do, because you hear that a lot, as though it never had occurred to anyone to make the moral case for free argument, which people have been doing fairly, you know, consistently for the better part of a couple of centuries now, starting with, you know, Locke and Mill and Smith and those guys, and up through Hayek and Milton Friedman and Ronald Reagan in our time. It's not as though the case hasn't been made, and it's not as though the other side doesn't understand the moral arguments we make. It's that they reject them. They just simply don't want to buy what it is we are selling. They have different sets of values. They reject the idea of liberty in the name of egalitarianism, in the name of what they imagine to be rationalism, but above all in the name of control. Control is really what the question is about. And all of our best things in modern life are systems that evolve on their own. They're iterative. They're widely collaborative. We call it market-based, but it's not always things that come out of markets. It's also just things out of civil society and cooperative institutions, whether it's software or pharmaceutical research or various kinds of social change. We have all sorts of things in which nobody is in charge. The example I always like to give, I have a new one that just come in the it's just come in the mail I saw at home, but the example I always use with students when I'm lecturing, because they get it, is I pull this out and I say, if you can explain to me why this gets better and cheaper every 6 months, but your public schools stink and they cost a lot of money, what we call public schools in the States. If you can understand that particular dynamic, you'll understand not every political problem we have, not every modern problem, but maybe 80% of the problems can be solved simply by appreciating that dynamic. But it never occurs to them to think of things that way. But the process that's used to build this and to improve this every 6 months can be applied to schools and healthcare and all sorts of other things. I think it can be applied to law and a number of other things that we think of as being necessarily part of political processes. And I know this seems like a radical idea to people who aren't used to thinking the way that we're used to thinking about things. I often get accused of being an anarchist and sort of the Murray Rothbard model of it. And I'm not really. I'm much more conservative than that. But when I do see headlines like this, I am sympathetic to the case. And of course, every year on tax day, I'm ready to move to Idaho and join a militia, because they don't let me keep my guns in New York. Anyway, they have to live in Connecticut, where they're Rogers neighbors, my guns are. Yes. One of the things I particularly like about technology products is their nomenclature, the way we name them. You get iPhone 4, iPhone 5, you get Windows 1.0, 1.2. It's sort of explicitly evolutionary. I like that. And there's always the assumption when you buy these things that it's not the be-all, end-all. It's not the best product there's ever going to be. Everyone buys these things, takes them home really happily, knowing that they are going to be surpassed within days or weeks. People will, of course, camp out to buy, which I always think is odd, to buy a phone. I mean, that's, that seems odd. But they'll camp out to buy this phone knowing that in a month it'll be $100 cheaper or $200 cheaper, which in a sense turns the conventional Keynesian view of deflation on its head, with no apologies to Richard Nixon. None of us are Keynesians now. There's this traditional Keynesian view of deflation, which holds that if prices are declining or quality is improving, then it's really bad for the economy because no one will make purchasing decisions, whether it's consumers or investors or firms. People won't put money into capital goods. They won't put money into consumer goods. But that's just flatly not true. And if you think about it, it's been obviously not true from the beginning. If that were actually how people made decisions, there would be no new cars ever sold. Because a used car is always so much better deal. You can pay $90,000 for a new BMW 7 Series, or you can buy one that's 6 months old, coming off a lease or been repossessed, for half the price. And everyone knows that, but people still buy new cars, as it turns out. People still buy computers knowing that the price is going to go down. They still buy phones knowing that the price is going to go down. And I think that the reason for that is that there is something in us that is programmed to seek out innovation. I think it is, it's part of our, literally part of our DNA. I think it's part of who we are as a species. We're a novelty-seeking, innovation-seeking species, and we are not, you know, homo economists, as the classical model has it. We will actually go out there and take risks and do things that we know are not actually, economically speaking, rational from a very, very narrow point of view. In fact, if we all did take that point of view, there'd be no entrepreneurship. We all know most entrepreneurial enterprises fail. Most new businesses fail. Most new product lines fail. Lots of investments don't work out. But we still go out there and we try to do these things. Most people who write books never publish them. And this is probably a good thing if you've seen. But there's something unique to this category of things, which is very characteristic of our time, which in economics they call network goods, which, of course, the value of a telephone is zero. One telephone is worth nothing because there's no one to call. Two telephones are marginally more valuable. A billion telephones are really, really useful because then you can pretty much talk to anyone you want anywhere in the world, and a billion people with email is pretty useful. But also from that sort of traditional deflationary point of view, this never should have happened either. There never should have been the initial investment in things like telephones in the 19th century, or in the internet, or in email and various other sorts of things we do. But these things do happen. Network theory typically holds that the value of a connected system is equal to the square of the number of interactions between people that happen on that system. So these things are becoming more and more valuable over time. It's actually it's the one class of goods that sort of turns the idea of scarcity on its head, that the more of them there are, the more valuable there are, and the fewer of them there are, the more scarce they are, the less useful they are. And of course, the ultimate network good is language. This is what traditionally anyone that's sort of Greek philosophers they held to makes us human. I think of language basically as a technology, as a kind of master technology. It's the thing that really enables the division of labor. And my argument has long been that really division of labor is what makes us human beings. It's what separates us from being just sort of naked, not very effective monkeys. I mean, there are other animals and other species that have some division of labor, but not quite the way we do it. And we have this enormously sophisticated planetary system we've developed without ever really meaning to, that allows us to do amazing things that are just would have been unheard of even a generation ago. Now, one of my favorite books is The Count of Monte Cristo, which, you know, growing up in sort of a, you know, poor backwater provincial kind of world, you can imagine why that book appeals to me, and also sort of having revenge fantasies. But there's a wonderful scene in The Count of Monte Cristo where Dantes is having his dinner party in Paris for all the aristocrats, and he shocks them all by serving not one but two different kinds of fish, and each of these fish is from more than 100 miles away. And he refers to it as a millionaire's whim. And he goes on for paragraphs talking about the preparations and expenses that he had to go through to bring his dinner guests in Paris two different kinds of fish. And everyone applauds when they come out. They think it's just the most remarkable thing. And I myself am not a millionaire in spite of the princely sum that Roger pays me to review plays. But if you walk down to the Whole Foods down the street from my house there, I counted them the other day, 81 kinds of fish for sale. To normal, regular sorts of people, anyone can go in there and buy it, and they do. But even, you know, as late as the 19th century, the early 20th century, this would have been thought of as just remarkable. These are the things we take for granted. And they all happen outside of politics. You know, the only class of goods we have that aren't getting better and cheaper and more plentiful every year are the ones that are touched in some way by the public sector. In the United States, we have, of course, a virtual monopoly on education, which is, I don't need to tell you all the real mess, but if you want to run the numbers, we are now spending twice in real dollars per student on education what we spent 25 years ago. Standardized test scores have not doubled, as you might have heard. In fact, they've stagnated. They've gone a little bit in the opposite direction. We do a pretty good job of educating people who are easy to educate, children of intellectual, professional, upper middle class families tend to do pretty well, but guess what? They were going to do all right, no matter what. In fact, most of them you probably could have left at home and put them in front of a stack of books and gotten roughly the same results. But we do a terrible job of educating people who are difficult to educate. I lived for some years in the South Bronx. I lived in what was, still is, I suppose, the poorest congressional district and the poorest urban zip code in the United States. I was an early stage gentrifier, and I was there because I'm a flinty cheap bastard, and I could, I could rent an apartment roughly the size of this complex for about, $1,000 a month or something. And the schools there are just shocking. Architecturally, they were prisons. They look like prisons. They have security fences around them and more closed captioning cameras than all of England put together, which is a lot. They want a kind of police model. If there's any educating going on there, it's absolutely secondary. New York City public schools graduate students every year who don't actually even speak English. Never mind reading or writing up to some level of proficiency. They actually don't speak English, and somehow they manage to get themselves graduated. And these aren't special schools. There are schools for people who speak foreign languages, for immigrants and things. The regular schools are also graduating students who don't actually have anything that you could, in any imaginary world, call literacy. And healthcare, of course, is another system that is nominally private in the United States, but about half of all spending on healthcare, even before PPACA was passed, was done by the public sector. It's essentially an extension of politics. And other things that we don't think about as much, but maybe we should. 97% of all mortgages before the financial crisis had some sort of federal component to them. They were either insured, guaranteed, or backed in some way by a federal agency, by Fannie, Freddie, or the FHA. We have all sorts of institutions like that don't work because they are in some way touched by politics, which doesn't have that ability to evolve. Whatever happens with Obamacare, you're not going to get a 2.0. You're not going to get a 2.5. You're not going to get it radically revised and improved every 6 months. You're going to get 1.0, and it's going to be there forever if it survives. I kind of don't think it actually will. But we're still using pension technology from 1935, right? We have Social Security. It was passed once. There have been some reforms and revisions over the years, but essentially it's still a 1935 system. Do we use any other products that were invented in 1935 that haven't been improved since then? I can't think of too many. Books. That's a technology that stood the test of time. Thank you, Mr. Goodman. What's that?
Shoehorn.
Shoehorns? Yeah.
Paper clips.
Paper clips. I do have a 1911 model Colt, which is still a very fine piece of technology. Or even those have changed a bit over time. What I think is remarkable, and we often overlook as conservatives, is because of the experience of socialism, communism, the Cold War, we developed a rhetoric that was really hostile toward anything that sort of smacks of collectivism. We've sort of ceded the word cooperation to the left. President Clinton at the Democratic National Convention the other day gave this speech about the virtues of cooperation, by which he, of course, means statism. But what's really remarkable when you think about what happens with 81 kinds of fish at the Whole Foods, with producing something like this with the internet, isn't that markets are competitive. Everyone competes over scarce resources. Groundhogs do that, spiders and mites and bacteria compete over scarce resources. What's amazing is the level of cooperation that we have to do these. And I think that we would serve ourselves well to develop a more intelligent rhetoric about that. That, look, there are actually ways we can make life radically better for people. For poor people, for people of modest means, for people who don't have intellectual gifts, people who have those kinds of challenges. There are things we can do that way, but we almost never talk about it. I mentioned this the other day after the Republican National Convention that I really do believe that the right has a much more effective message when it comes to things like poverty, when it comes to things like improving education for poor kids, for improving health care for people who don't have access to it. But I have never once, in the years I've been a national reviewer in politics before that, I've never had a Republican bring up the issue of poverty with me, unprodded. I mean, they've got good ideas about it, it's not something that's at the top of their mind. We have this kind of rhetorical hostility toward these sorts of things. I was reading something today talking about, you know, we're individuals, we're not like bees in a beehive. This sort of, you know, Randian rhetoric of heroic individualism, which is nonsense. We're exactly like bees in a beehive. We are social animals, we are evolved to be social animals. You take someone outside of the social goods. You don't even get Robinson Crusoe, because he at least had the benefit of things he remembered and things that he could imitate. You know, a human being thrown off onto his own is entirely useless and defenseless and will not live very long. We've got lots of good models for how to do things that way socially, but we don't talk about that a lot as conservatives. You know, speaking of bees, there was a wonderful book published last year called Honeybee Democracy, which is about how beehives make decisions, which they have this amazing involved decision-making process in which the scouts go out, and when they see new places they might move the hive to, they come back and they sort of vote on it. They have this odd, you know, kind of dancing thing they do. And the thing I especially most liked about it that I learned was that we think, because the chief bee is called the queen, so we think of them as being sort of monarchical. But it turns out the queen doesn't even get a vote. And I think that's maybe a healthy thing for honeybee society. And I kind of feel the same way about public servants. I think they maybe should be disenfranchised and not allowed to vote. So when we're talking about liberty, it's liberty to do what? There's a wonderful line in Hayek where he talks about the real value of markets, which is that we discover the most valuable ways to serve each other, which I think is absolutely true. But we don't speak about it that way, and I think that is it's a problem for us in the long term. So, which brings me back to what I'm starting with, which is the idea of liberty as an evolutionary strategy. You've either got liberal institutions or you've got central planning. You've got one or the other. And you can actually have this sort of radical experimentation under a liberal regime that you can't have under other sorts of governments, under other sorts of systems. And people, I think, they have an instinctive appreciation for that and how it works. You know, if you look at what people think about someone like Steve Jobs or even Bill Gates or Larry Ellison, no one resents them for their wealth. People don't resent a guy like Steve Jobs for his wealth. I mean, he's, you know, his net worth 20 times whatever Mitt Romney's was, but people don't resent him for it because they understand the value of that kind of entrepreneurship, of going out and creating something new and taking an enormous risk to do so. You know, if you ask someone what they think about Henry Ford, and what are the top 10 things to know about Henry Ford, well, people will say, well, you know, inventing the modern assembly line for production, that was a good thing. It was a nasty anti-Semite, that was a bad thing. But no one ever stopped to remark, well, he was a very, very wealthy man. I mean, he was. He was one of the, I guess, the wealthiest men in the country. But that's just taken for granted. In retrospect, no one really thinks that much about that. Whereas on the other hand, you have someone like Gwyneth Paltrow, who, you know, enjoys riches that the Sun King could only have dreamt of, but 20 years after she dies, no one will remember her name. They maybe remember the stupid name she gave her kids. Apple, I think is one. And that's kind of the paradoxical thing at the heart of Anglo-American liberalism, which is that we really secure the collective good that we never talk about by more or less ignoring it, by doing nothing to actually try to make people serve that. And we protect that protective good, that a collective good, by securing the rights of individuals to go out there and experiment and to discover and to fail. You know, failure is an enormously important part of the system. And that's what's distressing about what's happened since 2008 and 2009 with the banks and the insurance companies and now the car companies and various other kinds of things, is that once you take failure out of the system doesn't work. It just becomes non-productive, because that's how evolution happens, by enterprises dying the same way species die, the same way individuals die. If you don't let the natural selection actually happen, whether it's in the marketplace, in society at large, you don't have any way to get smarter, any way to get less wrong over time. Jim Manzi one of my colleagues has a wonderful thing he does where a little experiment for you. You ever play that game, I'm thinking of a number, you know, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 10, guess what the number is, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 20. Well, same thing, you have a number between 1 and billion. So a hard version of the I'm thinking of a number game. Now, just plain mathematically speaking, if I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 1 billion and you try to guess what it is, it would take you on average 500 million guesses to get it right if you're just guessing randomly. At one guess a second, that would take you about 16 years. But if you add a learning element into it, a kind of, you know, evolutionary element, where if I'm guessing the number and I tell you higher or lower every time you guess, well, if you do it the most intelligent way by starting in the middle and then going to the midpoint each time, it never takes you more than 29 guesses to come to the number. So with that ability to get a little bit less wrong in that sort of iterative evolutionary sense is the difference between spending 16 years and 500 million guesses trying to figure something out and 29 or 27 guesses in the course of maybe 10 or 20 minutes. Systems that can learn are much more effective. Political systems can't learn by their nature because there's no way for them to go bankrupt. There's no expense to being wrong. I mean, that's the real thing about politics, is there's no pain for being wrong. You can be wrong about any sort of issue. You can be wrong about the Arab Spring, as Andy has been reminding people. And there's a price to be paid, but never by you. You know, it comes maybe 20 years later. It falls on someone else. You see this at the high level, of course. I mean, no one in Congress is counting on Social Security for his retirement. But you also see it at the micro level. In the city of Chicago, 42% of the public schools teachers send their children to private schools. They know something about what's going on there. And of course, they get paid well enough that they can afford to send their kids to private school. Closing thinking about this, I was thinking about the potato famine the other day. I was reading an article about the Irish potato famine, and of course the problem, there are many problems. I mean, one was the interruption of trade and other aspects of misgovernance at that time. But the real biological problem, of course, was monoculture. There was one particular breed of potato that were called lumpers, and these potatoes reproduce like Democrats asexually. you know, you can cut off a little splice and put it in the ground, and they'll grow. And so you had a deal where the entire Irish potato crop was genetically identical. They were all clones of each other. And of course, when you have a crop like that, it's very, very vulnerable because there's no genetic variation. There's no diversity, another word we conservatives sometimes worry about, but you know, real diversity. And so, of course, when the slime mold comes along, or the blight, or whatever it was, and wipes it out, there's not that 5% remainder that's got enough genetic variation to be resistant to it. Monoculture crops fail, and monoculture products fail. If you look at, again, the mortgage crisis, you had essentially every mortgage in the country having the same legal and financial DNA. They were all produced under the same regulatory regime. They were almost all guaranteed by the same federal agencies, and produced by banks and mortgage underwriters who were operating under the same set of regulations, which caused them to make the same assumptions about capital requirements and collateralization and that sort of thing. I mean, there were mistakes made there, too, that didn't have anything to do with politics. There was just a lot of dumb banking and short-term thinking that happened there, too. But those sorts of products are very much like the Irish potatoes. They are all essentially the same. There's no reason, when you think about it, there's no real economic reason why every bank should have failed at the same time, why so many mortgages should have gone bad at the same time. There's really no reason why you should experience cycles within particular classes of products. There's no reason for home prices on the East Coast to do the same things they do on the West Coast, the same things they do in the middle, unless they're connected by something exogenous to those markets, which they are, which is this sort of unhealthy, heavy hand of regulation. In closing, the thing that drives me craziest about the debate over these things over the last few years, all this talk of deregulation. Well, if we hadn't deregulated the banks, then none of this stuff would have happened. Well, when did we deregulate the banks? We had stupid regulations of the banks, but banking and mortgage underwriting now, as then, is regulated as heavily as almost anything short of disposing of radioactive waste. You can't walk across your room in a mortgage underwriting office without filling out a federal form. Everyone knows this. It's not a question of regulation versus deregulation, but a question of stupid regulation versus regulation that sort of makes sense. Of course, the problem with regulation is that there's no real, good, reliable, guaranteed way of producing good regulation. I mean, sometimes you see ones that also evolve like products do, the English common law being an example of that, where you have individual decisions made over long periods of time, sort of sifted through society, and the reliable ones get retained and the other ones don't. And that's the source of my pessimism about politics, because I think almost all of our reform ideas are based on the ideas of getting the right people with the right ideas into the right positions. And I think that those sorts of agendas are actually doomed to failure, because it doesn't matter that much who you put in government if the system assumptions are still basically the same. We had very nice people in the SEC under the Bush administration. They did nothing. Chris Cox was fairly useless, I think. It doesn't matter if we have 16 years of Romney and then Ryan and then whoever else comes after that, if you're still trying to run something that looks like Medicare or something that looks like Social Security, these systems are doomed to failure no matter who is in charge of them. The best we can hope for is to try to shrink things back, and I think we actually have an opportunity to do that as you start seeing this headline written about the United States instead of Greece, which is coming. I mean, the math is what the math is. The money isn't there, and the day when we have to start making those decisions is, I think, pretty close at hand. And I think we, as people who believe in liberty, not just the freedom side of it, but also the order side of it, because you have to have a context in which these markets can operate and decisions can be made, are going to have to be there and be ready with some real solutions to these problems as they crop up once we get the opportunity to start making it, which my guess is maybe 2 to 5 years, we have to start making some really, really difficult financial decisions in the United States. And of course, the more pessimistic closing note is that's 20% of the world's GDP. It's not Greece. Thank you all.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
I think, should we have questions now or go through all the papers?
Questions now, I think.
Yeah, okay. Any
comments?
Yes.
I thought that Kevin put his finger on one crucial word, control, and associated with socialism that didn't get to the other crucial word, which is justice. His problem, your problem, I think, is Hayek's problem. Hayek went to his grave unable to understand why the evident superiorities of the markets had not really penetrated the world. And like Kevin, he came up with a kind of evolutionary notion. We had evolved in such a way that we wanted to enjoy tribal cohesion, and socialism was a sort of fake version of tribal cohesion. But the crucial thing, I think, is to recognize that we are the only civilization that is not based on a theory of justice. All the others, Sharia, new caste system, Confucian, etc., all have cooperative structures of social status that fit in together. And that's a kind of weird dream that everybody has. And in our civilization, it comes up as social justice. That is, the desire to control the outcomes in such a way that we get rid of inequalities, you know, indecent, obscene variations of wealth and things of that sort. That, I think, is the crucial passion to which politicians can always appeal, and which explains why these evident truths do not penetrate the skulls of the hoi polloi, as it were, if I may put it in that volume.
In some ways, I try to stay away from ethical questions, not only because, you know, my personal lapses, but we still don't agree on what thou shalt not kill means. You know, it's impossible to command any sort of political consensus on that question. It's a good way to move people around if that's what you're trying to do, and if I were running campaigns and elections, I would certainly make all of my arguments in those terms, because they're very effective. But in terms of actually trying to generate institutions that are durable and understandable and predictable, I actually think those questions are less and less healthy as, or useful, I think, as time goes on. not that I'm for abandoning the idea of ethics entirely, but I'm just going to leave it to other people.
It's interesting, Ken. I remember that Hayek in his little section on weasel words, one of his chief examples, of course, is the word social.
Yes.
Especially when linked with words like justice. You stop and think about it. What does the word social add to the concept of justice?
It adds nothing at all. The point about all these systems of justice is that if you're inside them, they look like the way all human beings should live. And if you're outside them, they look ridiculous.
I'd like to raise the question of why liberty has such strong, evokes such strong hostility from people on the, some people on the right, who aren't operating from motives of discontent and so on, of economic discontent and so on, or egalitarianism. I'm thinking about people like, you know, French conservatives and so on. And I think it's a cultural argument that they find the cultural life under capitalism distasteful. Now, I mean, I think one can knock that argument down, but it still is there. I happen to be at the Montparnasse Society meeting where the audience included Hayek and Friedman, and I think Popper actually, in which Irving Kristol produced his famous attack on thinking economically, when virtue loses all her loveliness. And I think it's there's a kind of a demystification implicit in liberal thinking about society, which means that a lot of people who want society to be at least have noble aspects, and I'm obviously thinking in part of nobility, but also nobility in a wider sense, they find the calculation of capitalism a kind of unpleasant one, and they think that the kind of culture that's produced by mass markets is undesirable and unpleasant and so on and so forth. I'm just curious as to where you fit that into your argument.
Yeah, I often think of the apocryphal story about the Maharana of Jaipur planning to come to the United States because she wanted to see the country in which the poor people are fat. And I think there is a tremendous emotional appeal to that, the sort of Pat Buchanan way of looking at the world. My own view is that you can have a theory about why we should feed the poor, or you can feed the poor. And we're actually pretty good at feeding the poor. You know, we're actually pretty good at solving problems, not from just a, you know, kind of utilitarian point of view. You know, from my view, that is the value. If you have a chance to make a society that's wealthier, in which people are materially better off, you sort of have a moral obligation to do that, instead of, you know, giving sermons about how we should care about people. We can actually empower people to go out and take care of each other. And it happens in a way that is interesting to me, because there's no, and I think this is actually part of the reason it's not appealing to people emotionally. In the market, there's really no occasion for gratitude. People make transactions. It makes everyone better off, but there's no need really to say thank you. I mean, sometimes we do sort of formally, but you've done it because you think you're getting something out of it. I've done it because I think I'm getting something out of it. And I think that does leave people a little cold, but I can't think of a better outcome than both people coming away from a transaction better off. It seems, you know, prima facie preferable to any other outcome, but there's no sense of emotional investment there.
Nobody lives inside a market. They have families and friends.
Well, sure, yeah, and those are, yeah, libertarianism is a theory of government, not a theory of life. You know, I think drugs should be legal, but I wouldn't let my kids smoke crack. You know, these are personal questions versus political questions. But in a sense, we do live in a market, you know. And you'll discover that you live in a market just as soon as, you know, you miss a meal. Once you start looking at real material privation, it turns out that this sort of cold-blooded economic thinking is awfully, awfully important to life. And that we have a lot more time for philosophical and ethical and moral questions once we've had a decent meal and a roof above our heads and reasonable health care and those sorts of things. I think that it's a, you know, it's the curse of abundance that we stop thinking about what it was that made that sort of society possible. And it wasn't, again, that long ago. You know, in the 1930s, you had hundreds of thousands of people in the American South dying every year from malaria. You know, something we now think of as being a third world kind of thing. In a very short period of time, you've seen an entirely private organization, the Rotarians. They got into their heads 20 years ago they were going to wipe out smallpox. And they did. They just did it. They went around the world vaccinating people and setting up programs. And the only place smallpox exists in the world right now is one little corner of Afghanistan that they can't get to, and one very remote part of Nigeria. This probably will never go down in the history books. No one's going to get the Nobel Prize for doing it, because you get the Nobel Peace Prize for writing memoirs, apparently, and pulling your chin up. But so we do live in that, not just market society, but in that voluntary and cooperative society. Almost everything good about modern life has come out of that.
So Daniel, then David, and then David.
May I just mention accountability? I very much liked what you said about the need, failure, and mistakes have to be part of the system for it to function, but that this doesn't work in politics, that politicians do not pay a proper price for their mistakes. And I wonder why you think this is. I mean, you gave the example of the Arab Spring. You know, we all remember President Obama going to Cairo, and, you know, as it happened, in the very front rows of the room where he was speaking at the university in Cairo were the Muslim Brotherhood. They were all there, and they listened as he explained that, you know, basically America was to blame for all their problems and this was all going to change now. And sure enough, they got the message. I think Mubarak got the message too. He was very angry indeed with this, and apparently obliged the president to climb up a very high flight of steps in order to reach Mubarak, in order to shake hands with him. Thereby, since you mentioned the pharaohs, I think the pharaoh was sort of making his point that he still was a pharaoh. But, you know, Obama got his revenge for that, because then, of course, Mubarak fell. And now we are where we are. And, you know, American ambassadors are murdered with impunity. Why is the president not paying a price for that? Why was it that when Romney, in an admittedly rather cack-handed way, trying to criticize the administration's policy over this, it was he who was pilloried and castigated. And he's now, he's got the message and he's shut up about it. He's not really holding the president to account. Yeah. So what's gone wrong here?
Well, I think that's it's a structural problem in democracy, which is there's no way to disaggregate the issues. You can't say, well, I'll vote for Obama on, well, I could think of something, but maybe I'm the sort of person who likes his health care plan. I'm for him on health care, I'm against him on Egypt, like him on taxes, dislike him on spending. You know, you can do that with other sorts of transactions, but you can't really do that in democratic politics. You just have the guy. You're either for him or you're for someone else. And Egypt, I'm guessing, on the typical American's list of concerns is, what would you guess, Andy, about number 338? Something like that.
But I would say this, though, I think it remains to be seen that he won't pay a price for it. At the moment, we have a media filter. I mean, we're not having a referendum on it. The reaction we're getting is the media reaction. Media is in the tank for Obama. But I remember, John, when Scott Brown ran in Massachusetts and won, it was in the height of the Obamacare debate. We had a slew of economic problems that have only gotten worse. Yet his campaign manager said at the conclusion, after he won, that the thing that really put distance between him and his opponent was the national security questions.
Yeah.
It was the places where, particularly in the debates, he was able to draw a very sharp contrast between where he stood and where she was coming from. So yeah. I think the jury's still out on that. I think, again, is what Roger said last night. I'm hoping that it's not my hope that'll be the case rather than reality. But I'm.
Does everyone here know who Scott Brown is or was?
Yeah.
Is.
Still is.
We hope he's
going to be the next senator of Massachusetts.
Pickup truck in his Red Sox ad, and incidentally, he's running against the single most obnoxious Democratic candidate in the country right now. She is your worst nightmare.
She's pretty bad.
Well, I don't know, Nancy Pelosi.
No, this is worse.
She's the original. You didn't build that.
Yeah.
Didn't he
piggyback
on
her? Elizabeth Warren is a great comedy act. I was in Boston for St. Patrick's Day for the annual political breakfast they have there, and I was following her around, you know, writing about the race. She, of course, wouldn't speak to anybody. I just kind of stalked her around. And in spite of being, as she called herself at Harvard, a person of color, she has
a Comanche, right?
She has a very waspy sense of rhythm. And so, you know, they're singing these Irish songs, you know, Charlie on the MTA and that sort of thing, which she does not know the words to any of them. You can tell she's kind of like, you know, looking very uncomfortable. But just watching her sort of like try to clap with everyone else here. You know, I'm surprised she's gotten as far in politics as she has because, you know, in spite of her proly kind of background, she does not exactly have the common touch. And she looks just manifestly uncomfortable in crowds of, you know, drunken South Irish Boston people. And even on the campaign trail, she seems that way. She's pretty good at making a speech because she treats it like a Harvard Law School lecture. And actually, we have a few people at National Review who had her as a professor at Harvard. And all admire her. I think she's a wonderful professor and a really compelling presence in the classroom. But as a campaigner, she's just, you know, she's Marie Antoinette, which is really funny given her sort of populist message. She's one of those, you know, populists who loves the world except for the people.
Right. Yeah.
Is this her first run for elected office?
Yes.
Yeah. Her last, too, by the way.
I was going to say that I wanted to ask about corruption. I mean, it seems to me that human beings everywhere, all the time, in every society, will be corrupt if they can.
Yes.
And you can't expect honesty of any sort. So people blame the market as being an instrument of corruption, that it's easy to trick it, to cheat it, and to make a fortune out of it at someone else's expense. And the corollary of that is that centralized planning actually can't be done without the secret police.
Right.
And people rather like the thought of the secret police because it will actually suppress corruption. It didn't, of course. All it actually did was engender it, because I think I'm right that in the Soviet Union there were only 5,000 items that were subject to centralized control, so that you suddenly discover that they weren't making radiators for certain diesel trains. And in order to get that radiator, you had to bribe the factory man, etc. But do you think that's right, that people would quite like the thought of the secret police to rule out the corrupt?
That's been one of those things that's always been a mystery to me. You take an organization like Goldman Sachs, and I'm not an enormous admirer of Goldman Sachs as a company, but they only do business with other sorts of institutions like them. If you're a Goldman Sachs customer, you're either a billionaire or you're another investment bank or you're a hedge fund or something like that. They're all pretty financially sophisticated players. It's really hard for Goldman Sachs to cheat its customers. And people keep coming back to them year after year because they make money for their clients. So if they were ripping them off, you would think that, you know, eventually these banks and funds and other sorts of sophisticated financial players would get the message, which of course they would. You know, in the marketplace, it's actually fairly hard to cheat people at a high level. People always bring up the case of Bernie Madoff. Doesn't that prove that it's easy? I think of about half of Madoff's victims as being co-conspirators. You know, when you see a line of return that looks like that year after year after year after year, something is not right, and you should know it. And if you're a multimillionaire, you should really know that. Now, no one complained as long as the returns, of course, kept coming in. But whereas in politics, I mean, I think in the United States, and I know less about Britain, I don't think that sort of gross corruption is really all that much of a problem. I mean, you see it sometimes at the local level. You see it a little bit at the federal level sometimes. what's problematic is that what normally would count in any sort of sane moral universe as corruption is perfectly legal in the ordinary way of doing business. Anytime you give people power, obviously they're going to abuse it. I mean, that's the nature of human beings. And I think that's, in many ways, the case for small government. Isn't so much that we have a really good list of it should do X, Y, and Z, but not 1, 2, and 3. But just the fewer things you give it to do, the more likely they are to get those things right, and the less likely they are to muck things up in the rest of society. You know, as you know, David, I began my journalism career in India, working for Indian newspapers, and shocking levels of political corruption there. You know, low level, high level, mid level, all the way across, which is just treated as a normal part of life. And of course, they have a very large and intrusive government that does lots of things, and does lots of things badly, and of course has lots of occasions for corruption. There was a guy there who was the their version of the Secretary of Agriculture, and they had this thing called the fodder program, which was a program for buying subsidized fertilizer for farmers. And of course he was just, you know, ripping this thing off as much as he could. And my newspaper broke the story, and one of the ways they were able to figure out that something was wrong in the fertilizer program was the vehicles they were buying to transport fertilizer, which included a sailboat. A Rolls Royce. And a few motorcycles and those kinds of things. When they finally got around to raiding this guy's house, he had, if I remember, $34 million worth of Indian currency in his home. Now, of course, the biggest note they make is the 500 rupee note, which is only worth about $11. So you can imagine what $34 million in rupees looks like. He had trash bags full of cash, full of 500 rupee notes, stacked, you know, floor to ceiling throughout the place. But, and this is typical politics, when they got around to arresting him, do you know what the political reaction was?
Cost issues, would it be?
A mob of his political supporters stormed our newspaper office, yeah, set it on fire, and stabbed the editor. With a pitchfork.
The same thing is affecting, unfortunately, some of the ethnic communities in Britain, that they are apt to see the, you know, any investigation of corruption on the part of their so-called pillars of the community as a tax on their particular ethnic group, which they're really not. But I mean, that's exactly the same problem, and unfortunately in Britain, in fact, Standpoint's had some interesting articles about the way in which the law is applied in a very differential fashion, you know, across the ethnic communities.
It was the case a few months ago, I'm not sure if it's still the case, that every member of Congress with an open ethics investigation at that moment was black. Now, granted, there were only four or five members of Congress who had open ethics investigation at the time. And, of course, some members of that community took that as, oh, they're going after our leaders. But, of course, you know, again, having worked in Philadelphia for a long time and watched this sort of racial politics in action, there's just something about particularly urban African-American politics that throws up really, really bad leaders. You know, you're sort of John Streets and... who was the guy with the cash flow freezer?
No, William Jefferson. Jefferson.
Yeah. All sorts of folks. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was he the guy who's the guy who thought that it was worried about more troops on Guam because it was a small island?
I wish it was. Yeah.
David?
Well, this comedian, I think his name is Louis C.K., mm-hmm, this guy. So he has this joke about flying in an airplane. He's always amazed at people who take the phones from the back of the seats and they're making, you know, mid-air flights, but they get outraged when the call is interrupted and it doesn't go through. And he says, well, don't you understand? You're making a phone call from a tube that's like shooting from the face. You know? And so I guess my question is, in the kind of 40 years of the era of Williamson, when, I mean, there has been a certain amount of innovation and success in the free market of political ideas. We've seen, you know, kind of the end of the Cold War. Hayek and Friedman has been exported to countries that have just revolutionized their economies for the better. And so there's been, you know, some innovation, some success. And I wonder, could that be, is that part of the challenge then? That enough has been done right that, you know, that it's less likely
to fail? And will it only take a major catastrophe at this point to derail these stagnant policies?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, sort of Higgs's thesis in reverse from crisis and Leviathan. You know, it's crisis that built Leviathan, and it's going to be crisis that unbuilds it. I mean, you do see things like, you know, very marginal, small changes in the right direction in political policy in various countries produce enormous results. You know, India's liberalization from the 90s forward brought 200 million people out of poverty, something like that. Chile and its pension system, those sorts of things. But I don't think they're enough to head off the sort of fundamentally unsustainable model that's still behind most liberal governments.
Ken?
Oh, just to qualify David Price Jones's pessimism about corruption. Hadn't understood. I think that all comprehensively just societies are systematically corrupt because the appropriate form of behavior is pleasing the person above you in the social hierarchy. Whereas our free societies are not systematically corrupt. I mean, you get fraudulent corruption all over the place. If you want a passport here, you don't have to bribe anybody, and that's power to give out passports and money and things of that sort. It is estimated that a Kenyan family spends about a third of its income on bribes. We are not in that situation, not yet, but we're certainly going downhill.
But look at Russia. I mean, Putin is the richest man in Europe by a long shot. You know, and he doesn't find it difficult to mobilize tens of thousands of people in support of him.
It's been a socially just society.
I think we're going to need to move on very soon, I think.
Well, just very quickly, there are lots of institutes for the study of the transformation of Eastern Europe and Soviet Russia to the new system of market democracy. But I haven't yet seen anyone draw a really interesting list of those countries like Estonia, which have made the transition very successfully, and those, well, like Russia, which haven't. And what they actually did, because they were, Leviathan was faced with a huge crisis in all these countries, and some of them did exactly what everyone around the table would like them to do, and have emerged very successfully. And others, of course, are still sunk in a terrible, I suppose, Romania, Bulgaria, Russia, still sunk in a terrible morass of economic failure and corruption and all the other ills. I mean, that's something which it seems to me we should all be looking at. But I, unless I'm wrong, has anyone done a systematic, interesting, persuasive study of the different transitions?
Not that I'm aware of. Deepak?
Yeah. A couple of points. This first, I want to start off with this thing about markets being cold, etc. Now, the thing is, markets, you know, the picture which people have of markets, the closest, I suppose, is a grain market. You go and buy something, you don't see it. But most markets which people have to deal with, the chap selling them is very interested in repeat customers. So it's not a one-shot game. It's repeated. It's only a repeated game. Both sides have an interest in maintaining the relationship. And that's why, even if the anonymous supermarket, you always remember to go to a nice one if the person at the till has been nice or not. So it's not asocial in the way people make that to be. I mean, in theory, you write the equation. But actually, and in fact, sellers go out of their way to make their markets, as it were, customer friendly. So I think that's a complete misnomer. That's not the worry one should have. The second point, is about corruption. Now, corruption is something which, if you come down to it, and we all agree, we all want to take a quick, quick buck. But there, repeat again, that if you have repeat relationships, you know, that again cuts down this, unless it's politically protected. Yes. And most sorts of corruption, you go and find, go and see how the hell is this chap continuing to do this. You find some political hand behind it. Now, why is politics corrupt? But, you know, politics don't create wealth except for maintaining order. The tremendous, give them the monopoly of coercion, they can use it for their own ends. Of course. No different for you and me. Hmm. So there, you would expect politics to get up. And it's taken a long time I mean, look at 18th century Britain. Totally corrupt. But it took ages, you know, it evolved, and now it's not legitimate anymore. But it does imply putting some sort of constraints on the rulers.
Okay, very.
So Montesquieu observed that the English Parliament was extremely, the individuals were corrupt, but when they had general policies to adopt, they were not corrupt. And I don't know whether this is true or not, but he made that distinction.
No, there was much later, I think, that you could say that about Gladstone. But I don't think 18th century Britain was totally corrupt.